So this class is called Everyday Emptiness, but if you see, as I sent the sign-up sheet around, I retitled it, Practice in the Zen Kitchen. And this is a class that I've wanted to teach for, I think, for a while, because I've been working in the kitchen here now for 9 months. And it's been really a wonderful experience. I mean, not just because I like the people that I work with, but because I've learned so much about practice and working in the kitchen, which is something I just absolutely never expected. When I came here, I thought, well, having to work is going to be an onerous part of being at Green Gulch. All I really want to do is sit around and be a scholar. And actually, it's been absolutely the inverse. The best part of being here has been working in the kitchen, and the most uninteresting part about being here has been being a scholar. So I'm not quite sure what that means.
Being a scholar wasn't what you thought it was. Maybe a scholar in the kitchen.
Maybe so. Anyway, but I am going to talk about emptiness. It's just I want to talk about emptiness from a practical point of view. And to get there, though, I want to kind of lay a foundation, sort of a psychological foundation. So the kind of structure that I imagine for this class is kind of the following, which is that I'm going to try and create some sort of context this meeting. And then over the next 5 meetings, which is the balance of the class, actually talk about everyday emptiness, or emptiness in the kitchen, or whatever else we want to call it. I mean, basic practice. Being somewhat unesoteric about emptiness. But I do want to create this common ground. And so for some of you, this will sound like some pretty old hat stuff. You've heard me say it before. And for some of you, maybe it's new. And I'll try and approach it a little bit different way. The other thing sort of about the structure of the class is sort of a ground rule. So this is now the second, one, two, three. I think this is maybe the fifth or the sixth class that I've taught in the last 9 months. And the same thing tends to happen all the time. I really like to talk with people. So people have questions, and then we get sidetracked. And I've lost enough of my intelligence over my lifetime that I forget what I'm doing. And then the class doesn't sort of go the direction I want it to go. And I do actually have a direction. So what I'd like to do is spend like the first maybe 45 minutes, I talk, you listen. And then the last 45 minutes, we talk, which means I also listen. And for people who are tired, and I know that it gets to be tiring to attend classes here, getting up so early in the morning, you can leave any time during the last 45 minutes, beginning, middle, end of it. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, take care of yourself. Don't feel like you have to sit around. Which is not to sort of denigrate conversation that might be going on, but sometimes people feel like they can barely stand to stay awake. Sometimes I'm the same way. Okay?
David, can we ask clarifying questions? Like, if you say something we don't understand, what you mean, or do you want us to save our ears?
Save it. Please save it. Because even clarifying questions, what will happen is I'll get into them and I'll really forget the direction that I'm moving. And the other thing is, I only know half of what I'm trying to do, and the other half happens when I'm talking. And if I lose track of that, it never comes back. And then I'm really in trouble. So I'm gonna, let's try it that way. I'll try and be kind of hardcore about it. Okay? Is that all right? If it's not all right, it doesn't matter. I'm going to be hardcore about it. Okay. So I've given a lot of thought to how do I sort of start here? How do I begin? And it's occurred to me that probably the best place to begin is with gratitude. is to recognize some quality of indebtedness. So I'd like to begin this class by remembering my teacher, Tara Tulku, and acknowledging that if I really know anything, he's to a great extent responsible for that. He and the whole Tibetan tradition often begin talking about the Dharma in a place that seems really simple and straightforward, and even, in fact, obvious, which is that basically we all will agree to the fact that we have a mind and a body. I mean, I suppose that there's some of us who won't agree to that, but it's probably rare. Most people will agree that they have a mind and a body. Although it may be very hard to know what that mind and that body are, but I think most people will agree that they have a mind and that they have a body. And those two bear some sort of relationship to each other, but they are probably not the same thing. In fact, even if you say, as an American, or as a Westerner, let's say, because everyone here is an American, even if you say, well, I don't really believe that I have a mind and a body. If you were raised in any contemporary Judeo-Christian society, whatever your ethnic background, if you were raised in this general culture, then you were raised in a world which is basically Cartesian in nature. And everything about the way in which you talk and think, all the ways in which you've been socially programmed, in fact, are manifestations of that kind of view of reality, which is that you have a mind and you have a body, and that they bear some relationship with each other, which is not entirely clear, but that they're not the same thing. In fact, curiously, that's also a Buddhist view. Now, where the Buddhist view and the Cartesian view differ are in a lot of places. And one of them is in the who has a mind and a body, or even the raising of a question, who has a mind and a body. But I'm not going to really pursue that right now. What I am going to want to pursue, though, is why we continue to assent to that certitude that these two things exist, when in fact there's nothing in our experience truly which will confirm the fact that we have a mind and a body, which are two separate things. Now, that's, I actually think, a very rash statement. So I'm going to try and follow this through a little bit. One of the foundation teachings of the Buddha was the teaching about what we call the five skandhas, which means aggregates or heaps, if you will. What the Buddha did in providing this teaching, giving this teaching, was he pointed to the entire range of human experience, and he said, it's possible to take all of human experience and categorize it, so that everything that you experience can be plumped down into one category or another. And so the five heaps were just basically the piles into which you could drop every kind of human experience. Like, here's happiness, you can drop it in this pile over here. And here's pain, you can drop it in this pile over here. And here is seeing, and you can drop it in this pile over here. And here's memory, you can drop it in that pile over there. He came up with five piles, five skandhas. Presumably, everybody knows what the five skandhas are, so I'm not going to review them particularly for you. But if you think about them, you'll notice that one skandha is basically what we call mind, the skandha of consciousness, which is something that has no physical aspect to it. It's something which is completely, purely non-physical. In some way, it's probably akin to what Descartes meant by mind in his philosophy. Then there's another pile which is called form, rupa. And basically what it seems to refer to is matter. It refers to, if you will, then, body, because that's what matter is. Okay. So I'm going to assert that of the five skandhas, One has to do with the mind that we presume ourselves to have, and the other has to do with the body that we presume ourselves to have. Middle age is catching up with me. Do I have a body? Well, I have cold feet. Which is actually my next point, which is, do I have a body? In fact, I can experience cold feet. But beyond experiencing cold feet, or experiencing coldness there, to assert that I have a body is taking a whole other step of abstraction. In fact, what goes on, and the only thing that certainly goes on, is the fact of having experiences. That we have experiences, certain sensations, which we consider to be physical sensations. And we have experiences of certain sensations, which we consider to be something out there. Right? So we have the in-here experiences and the out-there experiences. And some of the in-here experiences we see as being physical, and some of the in-here experiences we see as being mental. And most of the out-there experiences we see as being physical. But that's actually just another abstraction, too. Okay. The truth of the matter is, and I think you find this when you sit Zazen long enough, the truth of the matter is that all we have is sensations. And it's our minds, or I better change my language here. It's our cognitive process. It's our thinking. It's our concept formation that leads us to believe that some of our experiences can be associated with my body and that I have a body. And some of our experiences can be associated with my mind and I have a mind. And some of my experiences can be associated with an out there. In fact, that's a fantasy. That's imagination. In fact, all that we can be relatively certain of is that we have sense organs, and that the sense organs are somehow a place where matter and consciousness or mind or awareness come together, and that we hear and we see and we think and we feel. I should say sense, perhaps, propriocept, maybe it's better, and so on and so forth. That's really the only thing that we can be relatively certain of, and even that's a bit of an abstraction, because we assume we have sense organs based upon, you know, they provide information about each other, right? Often, you know, like I can touch my ears, if I do this, sound changes, so somehow this that I'm covering here is associated with hearing. And from that we abstract that we have a sense organ which hears. If I close an eye, if I close an eyelid, I stop seeing. So from that I abstract the fact that this physical thing is associated with seeing. Okay. In fact, other than doing that, we couldn't even be sure that it's true that there is a material aspect to experience, that it's not merely mental. And many schools of philosophy have, in fact, come to that conclusion. But the basic Buddhist view is that we have these senses, and experience occurs, and there's something truthful about that. Okay. Now, the point of all of this is that if we're honest in our practice, in our observation, in our discernment, we come to the conclusion that all of our experience, moment by moment, through any of our sense organs, is somehow always and intimately a coming together of our mind and something physical. Reb talks about this a lot. He uses different kinds of language to talk about it. But it's a theme that comes up over and over again. Each moment in every kind of experience we have, there's two things that are coming together so intimately that they almost can't be disconnected. Something material, something about the world, including this body, and something about our consciousness. And they so interpenetrate each other that in all honesty, we can't separate them. Abstractly, we believe we do. Abstractly, there is a world, and here is an object. And here is my mind, my consciousness. And abstractly, we assent to their being different, like mind and body are different. But the truth of our experience is, other than that, the truth of our experience is there's merely our experience. And matter and consciousness are thoroughly interpenetrating in each moment. Now, it's an interesting exercise to take that thought and sit with it in the Zendo. It's also a very interesting experience to take that thought and sit with it in anything else you do in your life. And if there's a sort of thread that I'm hoping will hold this class together, that's the thread. Exploring what does that actually mean. So I started out the class by expressing some gratitude. So I want to do it again, because Reb sort of, if I say harping on this point, it'll give it the wrong spin, but I'll say it anyhow. Maybe by belaboring this particular point over and over again, at least for as long as I've been here, that's been really important to me. It's really clarified some points. That in fact, the truth is you can't separate an experience. You can't separate your own mind from the supposed physical world. Now the implication of that, then, if we follow that through, the implication of that is really, I think, pretty interesting. Or the implications, maybe I should say, are really pretty interesting. Because most of what our mind seems to do in creating this world is impress on it our own fantasies. Now, in the five skandha system, there is a skandha called samskara skandha. And basically it refers to like habit patterns, all kinds of different habit patterns. It refers to more than that. I mean, all kinds of phenomena are stuck in that pile, like memory is in there. Attention is in there. And just lots of mental factors like that. But basically, it has to do with habit. It has to do with pattern. It has to do with the consequence of experience, which are laid down upon our minds in a way, which form or pattern our minds or the activities of our minds. And therefore, it's the sort of the locus of the fantasying or fantasizing that we do when we make reality. It's the locus of the fantasies that make one person attractive and another person not attractive. It's the locus of the fantasies that make one kind of work appealing and another kind of work unappealing, or one place to be of interest and another place not, or attractive, or so on and so forth. As long as our experience is one of an utter interpenetration of mind and world, then our experience is one of an utter interpenetration of fantasy or imagination and world, that they're really not at all separable from each other, that there's no moment when we encounter the world or matter or the external object or whatever you want to call this that isn't full of our fantasies about it. Now, the big problem in Buddhism, the big problem for human beings, is the operation of a certain kind of fantasy, a fantasy called self. Now, self is a real problematic and tricky word, because when we think of self in the sense of a person, an I, a subject. But self, especially for the early Buddhists, had a much broader meaning. Self meant like a thing, an entity, anything that was discrete. And early Buddhists refer to something called the self-habit. And they saw that as the real culprit in human experience, creating problems for human beings. The self-habit or the self-grasping habit, which is to say, the fantasy which operates in us all the time, which separates pieces of our experience into discrete things, different from other things, disconnected from other things, independent of other things, more appealing than other things, more unappealing than other things, more permanent than other things, or more impermanent than other things, closer or farther. Okay. The self-habit operates in the way in which each moment, the way fantasy happens, is to create a person apart from the rest of experience, and to create many discrete chunks of experience separate from each other. Okay. So, what we would call a thing, every separate thing, every identifiable thing, in this parlance could be called a self. So they're not just... Oh, wait a minute, a lot of people didn't sign up. There's not just 24 or 25 selves in this room, each of us. There's not just a Michael self, a Kay self, a Raymond self, a David self. There are all of those selves. But there's also a cap self sitting here on the couch. There's a couch self, if you will, a tape recorder self. Okay. All of these things have their own identity, and therefore their selves from this point of view. Okay, now I just made kind of a rash assertion here, which is that it's our fantasy mind, our fantasy fantasizing in this perceptual process, which makes all of these things. Now, the implication of that assertion is that all of these things, all of these selves, only exist on the basis of fantasy. That they don't exist on the basis of anything else. Okay. Now, fortunately, a lot of people called the early Buddhist teachers on this assertion, and they were able to logically demonstrate, in fact, the actual truth of the assertion. That it's only because of our fantasizing that these identifiable selves can, in fact, be ascertained. And that, in fact, if one looks closely at these apparently identifiable selves, they disappear, in fact. That if one looks closely, that is to say, at one's fantasizing process, it breaks down. It doesn't hold up. Now, the reason for this is that within each being, there is this capacity to discern the truth. There's also this capacity to experience the illusion-likeness, or the illusory nature of things. But there's also a capacity to discern truth. And people are capable of looking closely at the products of their fantasy, and discerning the actual nature of those fantasies. This capacity is what's called wisdom. Okay. So when you go in the Zendo, there's this statue sitting there, which is a statue of Manjushri, and that's the personification of that capacity to see truthfully what exists. Now, there's also an assertion made that if you engage that capacity, then that which is false disappears, and that which is true remains. And the reason for that is that that which is false doesn't exist. Only what's true exists. So if you discern what doesn't exist, it's not there. It has no basis. It disappears. But if you discern what's true, it doesn't disappear. As a matter of fact, it becomes more clearly what it is, because it has a true basis. So this being the case, if one were to investigate these various kinds of selves that one experiences from the point of view of this type of mind called wisdom, if, in fact, these various selves were not fantasy productions, then they would become more clearly what they appear to be. But if in investigating them, they became less what they seem to be, in fact, completely disappeared, then they must, in fact, be nothing more than mere fantasies. The disappearing of those apparent selves under analysis is what's referred to as their emptiness. Because the process of analysis empties things of what's not actually there, just like pouring water out of a pitcher. If something were actually there, analyzing it would not make it disappear. But if it's not there, then analyzing it correctly makes it disappear. It empties the phenomenon of its apparent qualities. Now, in fact, this is all that this mysterious word emptiness refers to. It simply refers to that which is not actually there. But of course, like so many other things in Buddhism, all these simple things are actually more complicated than one might want them to be. They're not really that simple. Because to first discern the emptiness of something, to analyze something, to discern its emptiness, is what I'm trying to say, you have to first find it. I mean, maybe we don't think about that too much. We assume we can find it. But actually, if you investigate, you find it's a big problem to find this thing that you're trying to analyze and either empty of fantasy or ascertain its actual existence. In fact, it's the biggest problem. In fact, you can't find anything when you try to analyze, to discern its existence. Just another few minutes. One of the ground rules is when you're here at 7:30, you've got to stay until like 15. Whether you're awake or not. I don't mean to embarrass you.
I wake her up.
Yeah. Last time I taught, Kirk sat over there and Jay sat over here every class. They said the reason they did that was because they'd be embarrassed if they fell asleep. So that way they can stay awake. But they fell asleep all the time. Okay, so where were we? Oh, yeah. The difficulty in discerning things. Okay. In fact, it becomes a real problem when you try and find anything to analyze. It becomes an incredibly difficult problem to find anything to analyze. And in fact, that becomes the heart of what the method is. And in fact, it becomes the heart of what the method is of the practice of everyday emptiness. Subject of the class. So let me get unabstract for a minute and get more concrete about what I mean here. So this is where some of my friends here will get really bored because I'm going to start talking about carrots. So I talk about carrots a lot. And I talk about carrots a lot because I spend a lot of time with carrots in the kitchen here. And carrots are nice for a whole lot of reasons. I mean, it's kind of unfortunate that we don't grow them here. It would make everything a whole lot more interesting if we did. But
we could try.
Maybe instead of talking about carrots, I could talk about... we don't grow any other roots that I like. Well, I could talk about potatoes. We grow potatoes. Let's talk about potatoes instead. Because we grow those. Yes. Well, we have to talk about tubers. I don't want to talk about leaves. I don't want to talk about flowers. No, I don't want to talk about squash. I don't like rutabagas. Oh, definitely not. We're gonna have to stick with. It has to be something that I like.
Same with your carrots, right?
No, because no. I think it's potatoes. We'll go for potatoes. Okay. When I find myself in the kitchen, okay, so let's radically shift gears. When I find myself in the kitchen, there's a number of things that I might find myself doing. But frequently what I find myself doing is cutting vegetables. And what I found is that if I just, you know, like cut up the 3 gallons of potatoes that I'm supposed to be cutting in the usual way in which I cut potatoes, it takes about 5 minutes, and I'm unbelievably bored. And the task becomes an absolutely intolerable task. So, out of sheer survival, I had to figure out some sort of way to deal with these gallons of vegetables that had to be cut in the kitchen. Now, I'm the kind of person that has one of these minds that is used to having lots of inputs, lots of stimulation. I mean, besides television and everything else, you know, I went to college, and then I went to graduate school, and then I went to graduate school again, and then I went to graduate school again. And then I wasn't tired of it, so then I started teaching. So I have it pretty bad as far as, you know, having a complicated mind requiring a lot of stimulation. So you can imagine that sort of 5 mornings a week in the kitchen of doing nothing but cutting vegetables for sort of months stretching out ahead was going to be a pretty problematic experience for me. And something had to happen or I wouldn't have to be able to cope with it. Now, I wouldn't have figured out any way to deal with this particular problem myself. But fortunately, all the other influences that have been floating around, such as some of the ones that I alluded to earlier, basically came to my rescue. And it occurred to me that these potatoes that were sitting in front of me probably had a quality that was very different than what I was experiencing. I mean, I used to walk into the walk-in, and I'd pull a bunch of potatoes out, and I'd put them on the table to start cutting them. And I noticed that what my mind did was it just sort of assumed like the potatoes lived in the walk-in. They were just there, you know, and I would walk in and take them. And what my mind didn't do was my mind didn't notice that maybe Kirk had dragged those potatoes in from the fields the previous day and put them in the walk-in. I mean, in fact, even if I'd been in the kitchen the previous day and Kirk walked in with his box of potatoes and put them in the walk-in, my mind the next day refused to make the connection that the reason those potatoes were there when I pulled them off the shelf in the walk-in and took them out was because of something that Kirk had done. And I started noticing that my mind always did that. And the other thing that my mind always did was it refused to pay any attention to what I was actually doing with these potatoes, in the sense that, I mean, it would notice that I was cutting them, but that was the end of it. It wasn't really thinking, it wasn't really observing, it wasn't really attending to where the potatoes were going. There was just these potatoes right there that had mysteriously come from no place and were mysteriously going to no place in particular. And as long as I assented to that, I found myself unbelievably bored with cutting potatoes and skinning potatoes and washing potatoes and oiling potatoes and cooking potatoes and doing anything else. But when I started thinking about my mind's ignoring some essential aspects of these potatoes, then cutting the potatoes got interesting. Now, there was another dimension to this, which was if I only thought about where these potatoes came from and where these potatoes were going and wondered about it, I had to be very concerned about my fingers, because there was a real problem, which was keeping my fingers and my knife in proper relationship to each other if I was wondering about where the potatoes had come from and where they were going instead of paying attention to the potatoes. Because it didn't seem at first like I could do both. It turned out that that wasn't the case. In fact, what I found was if I looked really closely at the knife in my right hand, the potato in my left hand, and the movement that I was making as I cut the potato, if I looked really closely at it, I actually saw the potato. And there was no danger of losing my fingers. The danger was when I wasn't looking at the potatoes, right? But it turned out that at the same time, I could actually see where they'd come from. And I could actually see where they were going to. But it required the engagement of a faculty that I had always seen as being a problem, in fact, a culprit in life. It involved engagement with something I referred to earlier this evening, imagination or fantasy. In this tradition, in the Zen tradition, it seems that we're told to just pay attention to what's right there and to not have fantasies about what's not right there. In fact, to not have fantasies at all. So in what follows, I may diverge quite significantly from the Zen tradition and step into the Tibetan tradition. Because in the Tibetan tradition, the view is quite different, which is that this culprit of fantasy and imagination can also be an ally. And so I started learning how to make this an ally. And I kind of wondered about what I was doing for a while, if I was sort of like veering off the path, if I was wandering into territory which was very problematic. But as is usual in these situations, my lama came to my rescue. Now, he's been dead for a few years, but one of the things that I'm doing here is I'm listening to tape recordings of his teachings, and I'm organizing them and so on and so forth. One day I came across a tape in which he was talking about the way in which our imaginations make this world of things we believe ourselves to live in the way I was talking about earlier during this class. And that's the source of a lot of problems. But he said, what the heck? We live in a world created by imagination anyhow, so why don't we live in a world in which we use our imaginations to benefit ourselves instead of merely using our imaginations to create problems for ourselves? We're not going to cease living in a world of imagination, and we're not going to make our imaginations go away. So why don't we use our imagination intelligently to help ourselves? And he uttered there was a big belly laugh that was going on as he was saying all of this. So I don't know, there may have been a subtext to this particular message. He seemed to be very jovial at the time. But anyhow, that seemed to sort of confirm what I was getting into with my carrots and my potatoes, which was, as I was cutting them, I started thinking about Kirk, or whoever was bringing the potatoes in, or Michael, or whatever. And I started thinking about the mornings in the fields when I was capable of getting up and doing the weeding, which weren't all that many, I'm sorry to confess, during our community work in the garden. And I began reflecting on all the amazing amount of work that went into the planting, nurturing, and harvesting of these potatoes, which my mind continued to insist just sort of magically appeared in the walk-in. I mean, I actually couldn't see it. My mind simply continued to be sure that potatoes just existed in the walk-in. That's where they came from. But in my imagination, I could see all these people that I was getting to know working in the field, and sometimes even myself, and see in my imagination how they were responsible for these potatoes coming into the kitchen. Then my imagination, I could reflect on the sun shining here at Green Gulch, and the rain coming in, and so on and so forth. All of these things coming together to, in fact, make the potato that was sitting there in front of me. Why do I want to say carrot? Carrot's a more interesting vegetable, I guess. Anyway, potatoes. So I was exercising my imagination in this particular way. And I found when I did that, something really unusual happened. And what that was I was no longer bored. Okay. And I found that I could spend an entire morning cutting potatoes and never be bored, and thoroughly enjoy cutting potatoes, and look forward to coming back the next morning and doing more potatoes. And in fact, the next morning. Okay. And in fact, what I discovered was, if I took a vacation and left Green Gulch for a while, I had to get into the kitchen and start cutting up vegetables. I actually missed it. Now, this is a very radical thing, as my wife will certainly assert to get me in the kitchen at one time required probably an electric cattle prod, you know. And suddenly I sort of, you know, you couldn't keep me out of the kitchen, so what was going on? Now, the other side of this, I mean, that was pretty interesting, but the other side of this was I began to wonder about where was this food going? I mean, it's one thing about where is it coming from, but it's another thing about where is it going? Now, even if you're cooking these carrots, potatoes that you've been cutting up, sort of, and you get this soup, which is maybe sort of nice to make, and, you know, 10 minutes after 12, you carry it out and put it on the table. While you're doing it, you don't really see what's happening. You don't really see that, in fact, every potato that passes through your hands is going to end up in the soup, because you're right there with the potato. More significantly, you don't see that every potato that passes through your hands ends up in the spoon of a friend of yours. And even more significantly, what you don't see is that every potato in those spoons ends up in the bodies of your friends. In fact, becomes the bodies of your friends. In fact, becomes the energy of their own awareness. In fact, becomes the capacity for them to sit in the zendo and practice zen. Okay. In fact, becomes the capacity for them to engage in the process of becoming a Buddha. Now, sometimes in Buddhism, we refer to the fact that we are Mahayana Buddhists. We say that we're practicing to achieve our liberation or our enlightenment for the sake of all beings. It's called bodhicitta. Okay. We say it a lot, but I don't think very often we know what it means, even though we say it, or really see what it might mean. But this, in fact, is one of the things that it means. Because as I was cutting these carrots and potatoes and things, and reflecting on the fact that the food that I was involved in preparing was what made this Sangha, permitted this Sangha to engage in its practice. Okay. Permitted this Sangha to seek liberation for the sake of all sentient beings. Then what I was doing was I was actually cutting potatoes for the sake of all beings. Literally, I was cutting potatoes for the sake of all beings. Now, when I saw that, I was really on board. It made cutting vegetables really very interesting. But it was completely a fantasy. Because no matter what I did, the potato was just a potato. And the past of the potato and the future of the potato, where it was going and how it was being dedicated and who it was turning into, were just fantasies at that particular moment. Just as my reflections on where it had come from were just fantasies at that particular moment. Or were they? Or maybe they weren't. Maybe they weren't just fantasies. Maybe there is a way in which fantasy and imagination about these, what are called in Madhyamaka philosophy, three moments of time, aren't just fantasy and aren't just imagination. So, what we do in the next five meetings is, in fact, explore that question. Explore the question of fantasy, imagination, the future, the past, and how these things connect in the present moment of cutting vegetables or cooking soup or offering incense in the kitchen, which we do before we prepare meals, and making vows in the kitchen, which we do at the end of prepared meals. So, it's 8:15. So at least tonight, I'm a man of my word. So that's where, in a sense, I'll stop. And if you want to take off, please feel free. And if you want to ask questions or argue or whatever, feel free also. And if you have nothing to say, we can all go to bed early. And if you have nothing to say, we can all go to bed early.
I have a, you know, when you talk about using imagination to sort of expand or, you know, well, for one thing, just to alleviate boredom or make something more interesting, but more than that, to see something more in something that's every day. Like, I've done that too, but not so much in the time, you know, dimension. Like, you're thinking a lot about the past of a potato and its future. And I think that sometimes when I'm looking at things like, say, a carrot or a potato, I try to see more than I normally see in its actual manifestation in the moment. For example, it's very easy to have like a one-dimensional or two-dimensional perception of a very familiar object, but if you look at it more carefully, sometimes it gains new characteristics. For example, a cut potato or carrot has a translucency,
mm-hmm.
and there's a line in an old hippie song. There was a band called the Incredible String Band, and a line in one of their songs goes, "Wearing black cherries for rings," and a friend of mine used to like do things like take a piece of fruit and cut it and look inside and see this, you know, very intricate, beautiful, you know, translucent pattern that could transmit light, you know, and sort of like prize these things as like a jewel, you know, like a cut cherry, for example, has a very interesting appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when we have, a lot of times we have image, part of the problem of imagination is the reduction of reality to a kind of a rote form or a symbolic form. Like a cherry is a round red thing with a stem coming out,
mm-hmm.
whereas what a cherry really is something incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do, you know, to, you know, about what's immediately in front of me is to see what's immediately in front of me, which I don't.
I'm not sure that you're asking a question that requires an answer.
No, it's not really. It's just another observation about how.
Comment on it.
What's that?
Although I can make a comment
okay.
on it. The comment that I would make on it is that from an aesthetic point of view or an experiential point of view, what you're talking about is great. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in fact, it's art, right? It's like the appreciation of art and the appreciation of the world as art.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not what I'm talking about, which is an expression of middle way philosophy in the moment. I'm talking about investigating the moment as a philosophical exercise, but concretely investigating the moment as a philosophical exercise. And I'm not going to say one is better than the other. I'm just saying that the intention is different in the two of them. I mean, for myself, there are plenty of times when the sheer joy of cutting carrots and trying to get every round to have the exact same thickness and texture and to move the knife in a certain way is really an exquisite experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have anything to do with discerning the life history of the carrot and cutting carrots as a bodhisattva activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great experience. But that's
mm-hmm.
not the kind of experience that I'm talking about, because it's pleasant, but it doesn't change me in any particular way.
I would say that to look at something and to see aspects of it that you haven't observed before does change you, and it is part of the bodhisattva path. Because, for example, to notice the translucency and the venation, say, in the pulp of a cherry, might suddenly, you know, make you aware that it's a living thing that you're dealing with here,
mm.
and it's something that your mind can't even grasp. is actually occurring. Actually, live processes are happening right here in your hand. And so to sort of like force open the, you know, the doors of, you know of the categorization,
mm-hmm.
I think does cause a change in yourself. It's not easy to do, but
okay. Yeah, I can agree with that. I can't disagree with that. That sounds fun. Stuart?
I was just reflecting on the question of whether what you're discussing is consonant with the method of Zen. It's not outside the method of Zen.
Really?
I think that the emphasis in Zen practice is to deal with what is immediately present, but that's a ground level practice, and it is just the sort of practice that you were describing at the beginning. I think the beginning, as a preliminary practice, the preliminary practice is to try to free up the apprehension of immediate experience from habits of thought that becloud the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's part of the method of Zen to deny the extension of experience, the dropping away of all limits
mm-hmm.
to experience in the immediate.
My experience has been that skillfully employing this kind of imagination actually generates an experience in the present moment of the past and the future, not as a fantasy or an imagination or as an abstraction, but as a concrete. But that the means or the vehicle for getting there is through using the imagination. So maybe we don't disagree, and maybe I'm not off in a non-Zen sort of way, but I'm not aware of a Zen teaching that suggests that you employ the imagination to get to that point. It always seems to me that it's more like if you're very attentive to what's there, aside from imagination, then future and past will appear in the present moment. And here I'm talking about technically, as a yoga, a different approach to it. And that's why I sort of made that point. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I mean, I'm far from an expert on Zen.
I'm not clear, about that. But mm-hmm. I was thinking about the Fa Yen teaching,
mm-hmm.
and that when I was reading it seemed entirely consonant with meditation, zazen
mm-hmm.
experiences, which is, entering in the left ear and emerging from the right eye, entering in the 19th century and emerging in the 31st, entering as a man and emerging as a woman, going in the left side, coming out the right side, starting as a bodhisattva and ending as an ox, that the description of the melting boundary
mm-hmm.
and the opening
mm-hmm.
to infinite possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think I think that's recognizable as part of the activity. Whether it's something that's induced intention, whether the intentional induction of it through imagination is part of the method of Zen or not, I'm not quite sure. But I think it matters less as long as the preliminary step is taken. That is to say, the surrendering, first the surrendering of habit of thought.
Mm-hmm.
The second is not reifying the imagination,
mm-hmm.
the imagined experience.
Yeah, now you're getting into the technical way of using the imagination in a way which is liberative and not binding, actually. When you talk about not reifying what you're working with in imagination. But I'll tell you the thought that occurs to me when you're talking about Hua Yin in particular is when I think of the Mahayana Sutras that were so popular in China especially, they are phenomenal expositions of imaginative Buddha realities, if you will, that if you read them, if you really throw yourself into the Lotus Sutra or the Avatamsaka, you throw yourself into a phantasmagoric, unbelievable world of expansion, which is more remarkable than anything I could ever imagine, And what it does is, in fact, it takes the kind of interconnectedness that you're talking about and the dissolution of rigid, railified ways of thinking. I mean, it removes them as you throw yourself into that world. You can't bring those things with you. So it does seem to me to function in that kind of way. Again, I don't know where that fits with Zen, except that these are all precursors of the Zen tradition, that they're all ancestors, literary ancestors in the Zen tradition. Yeah. Actually, Raymond had the next question. You had your hand up. If we're finished, are we finished?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I want to come back to the fantasies. The way I understood, there are two different kinds of fantasies, right? There's one that leads you to a realization of the interconnectedness of everything. It's kind of a liberating fantasy. The other one, of course, is a fantasy that leads you, gets you more into the separation. That's the kind of fantasies that makes you suffer whatsoever. So, is that what you want to say?
Yeah. Yes, it is. And more particularly, this is a good time to note that the kind of fantasies that I'm talking about, or use of imagination that I'm talking about, which has a liberative outcome, is, in a sense, it's a restricted use of imagination or fantasy. Restricted in the sense that it's founded on, or it develops out of, a pre-existing investigation of Buddhist philosophy and worldview. That it's not mere fantasy. It's not just any old fantasy. It's not any old kind of imagination. But it's imagination that's used in the service of what's already been rationally investigated and discerned in a philosophical sense. So if I'm talking about having a fantasy or an imagination about how the carrot appeared before me, it's happening within the context of a set of themes established by having already spent a long time studying middle way philosophy. It's not just any old fantasy. Again, this particular kind of approach comes out of my own training. In fact, in Tantra, right, in Vajrayana Buddhism, where one uses the imagination in extremely specific ways, where there is a specific kind of litany or imaginative drama that one engages in, very specified, not just any old thing. And then it has a certain outcome. And if you don't pursue the right kind of fantasy in the right kind of way, you don't get the right kind of outcome. You can't just do any old thing. So I wasn't specific about that, because essentially what I'm trying to do here is sort of introduce something without getting into the details, saving those for later. But it's good you bring the point up, because it could lead to easily to misunderstanding, especially problematic for people who aren't coming back. So thank you.
How is it that imagining the past of the carrot and the future of the carrot is a specific outgrowth of Madhyamaka philosophy?
Well, we'll have to, I think, hold... I'd like to hold that for another class, because to answer that question it would take about a half an hour.
It seems, kind of obvious, simple imagination exercise.
But it's not. You could make it such as an obvious, simple imagination exercise, like remembering Michael walking in with a box of potatoes. Like, okay, Michael walked in with a box of potatoes yesterday. Remember that as you're cutting the potatoes. And, well, he had to get them from someplace. Remember that. And that's the kind of imaginative exercise you're talking about, which is perhaps interesting, but one wouldn't expect it to be particularly liberative it wouldn't transform one's experience of the potato in front of one, I don't think. It might make you a little less bored, but only because I think it would space you out in a certain way, take you away from the task. But that's not the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that's very different. Something that's different because it's rooted in a very specific and precise logical analysis and understanding of the relationship of moments, cause and effect, and interdependence, these kinds of things. So although I'm talking about this in broad brush kinds of themes, the actual practice of it is not that. The actual practice of it is different, and therefore has a significant different outcome, I think. But really, the question that you ask is important, and it deserves the complete answer that I'd want to give it. If I say that that's about a half an hour answer, and it's upcoming, it's the most honest thing that I can say. So, can I leave it at that?
Yeah.
Stuart's point, or how this applies to, I think, what we talk about here, and the idea of fantasy is what they talk about, delusion is not separate from enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, actually noticing how the mind is working all along the way, in fact, I think that's part of the, or maybe I'm tricky water here, but anyway, the meditation instruction, in a way, is to get more and more intimate with how this, how your mind is working and following the various paths that it moves along. So I feel like what you're employing, in a way, is just a different way of saying.
It's true.
Maybe what we're already saying here. So
you're right. The way I would phrase it would be more in the context of the two truths, or in the context of nirvana and samsara are not fundamentally other than each other. That sort of cutting the potato as if it's just sitting there, that's cutting the potato in the realm of samsara. But cutting the potato in relationship to nourishing all sentient beings to the activity of the sangha is cutting the potato in the context of Mahayana, cutting it in the context of nirvana. In that sense, and discerning that truthfully, they do actually come together. But doing it by the sort of skillful employment of imagination, maybe that's a better word than fantasy, by the skillful employment of imagination, is doing it in the same way as when we are in the Zendo and we turn to the statue and bow three times. It's the same process that's going on. Because what is going on when we're bowing to that statue? We're not idolaters. There's something else that's going on, I hope. There's something else that's going on. What's going on when we're bowing to that statue is, I'm going to assert and try and develop in this class, no different than what can be going on when we're cutting potatoes, watering vegetables, making beds, bringing down the mail, or making a town trip. The same process could, in fact, be going on. Pardon me for this word, but I'll say should be going on.
So the thing is, though, or I think what you did, I mean, well, there are complex things that you did, but what I sort of made a note to myself is that you actually emptied boredom.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
The emptiness of boredom.
but I guess one of the problems I have in me is that you picked carrots or potatoes or town trips or beds. These are sort of concrete objects in a way. We've used our imagination or fantasy or agreed upon delusions to identify these certain things so we can go back and forth. But it seems like this gets a little bit shaky when you start talking about things like values or ethics or philosophy or something that's not so tangible in a way that maybe we all agree on and talk about what happened or didn't happen.
I don't think it's any different. I think It's easier to begin the dialogue with something concrete like a carrot. Just like it's easier to begin talking about emptiness by deconstructing a table in front of one. But actually, I don't think that they're any different at all. I think in some ways the process is more dangerous for us because it's more likely that we're going to fall in some sort of nihilistic error when we begin to deconstruct or empty values or sort of philosophical positions. Then it gets kind of dangerous. But, the table before me is something that I'm going to deconstruct or empty of fantasy, negative fantasy. It's a creature of my eye, if you will. But the values are simply creatures of another sense organ called mind. But it's more open to nihilistic problems, I think, because it's a value rather than a thing. But I really don't think they're any different. We'll come back to that one, too.
Right. Maybe next meeting you could deconstruct honesty.
Oh, that's really easy. Deconstructing honesty is easy. The question is, what are you going to be left with afterwards? And the problem there is, if I deconstruct honesty and you don't really have, I don't mean you in particular because my guess is that you do, but if one deconstructs honesty and one doesn't have a larger view or a deeper rooting in Buddhist philosophy and ethics, then the outcome is definitely nihilistic. And really dangerous, really problematic. I'll repeat a warning that the ancestor of this system, Nagarjuna, makes, which I repeat in every class, that it's better to have never encountered Buddhist philosophy than Buddhist philosophy of emptiness, than to encounter it and think that it means nothingness. But that's the most dangerous mistake one can make. Or in a more poetic sense, Nagarjuna says that if you grasp a serpent by the tail, it bites you. If you grasp a serpent behind the neck, it doesn't bite you. And so emptiness is like a great serpent. And you have to grasp it in the right way, or it's the most dangerous thing possible. Especially when you start using it to deconstruct values like honesty, integrity, and what have you, you can think, well, psst. But that's emptiness is not nothingness. It's something else. I'm not going to try and say what something else is right now.
I was wondering about.
What are your names, by the way? You introduce yourselves, and I'm not good with names, I'm sorry.
Heather
and?
Jeremy.
Okay.
I was wondering about your awareness while you were in the kitchen cutting vegetables and you're having this. Or imagining the past and future of the carrot in the past and future of present as you're cutting them, were you also aware of what else was going on in the kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
And so you could respond just as quickly to.
Well, I noticed that let me put it this way.
So you weren't spacing out.
Right. Okay. Let me put it this way. The concreteness of it is, and the way you can get the concreteness of it is, on the one hand, I still have all my fingers, right? That's one level of concreteness. But you're asking a different kind of question, and that is, do I start bumping into the people walking behind me as I'm doing this? And the answer is no. And not only that, I avoid people who are so spaced out that they're about to bump into me. So it is not a spaced experience. That's why I try to make the point that I'm not talking about fantasy as a kind of like wandering away from the situation. But fantasy or imagination of a very different character. It's actually, it brings you right there in a very real way. And the point is that ultimately what happens is that imagination turns into direct experience. In other words, I can imagine that the carrots and potatoes that I'm cutting are going to turn themselves into happy meditators. But there are times, in fact, when what I see before me intermeshed in the vegetables are happy meditators. And it's not a complete self-delusion, because when I'm cooking, when people like the soup, I hear about it. And when it's beautiful, I hear about it. And if I'm cooking the soup in a crappy mood, nobody ever says, that was a great pot of soup. Never. It's never happened to me. It's never happened to me. But when I'm working on the soup or the vegetables, in a different kind of frame of mind, that's the only time that positive responses come back. And totally imprinted on my mind on this issue is one day when I was making a salad, and I was into it in the most profound way. I brought it out into the dining room. Michael was out there. I think you remember this. Emily, I think you had brought in some nasturtiums, which we put on the salad. And I brought this out, and it was like radiating. It was unbelievable. It was the most unbelievable thing I'd ever seen. It was around the time that this stuff was starting to come together for me. And Michael looked at it, and like the eyes popped out of his head. It was, he's just like, he was like not the same. So it's not mere abstraction. There's something else that that goes on in this process. Yeah, it really was. So I mean, that's like cosmic. No, it was really concrete. It wasn't cosmic, but it was incredible. You brought the mysteries, didn't you? Or was it somebody else? Or was you?
I'm having a hard time with this.
Okay, hang in there with it for a while.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah, when I'm listening to you talk about the potatoes in terms of basically their dependence upon cause and conditions, I think it's that particular level of dependent co-arising. And in listening to this before, these arguments before about Thich Nhat Hanh does this a lot about seeing the clouds and the lumbermen in a piece of paper.
Yeah, right.
I keep feeling that I want something more radical from this. That when I work with this, I can look at it and start to see what all has gone into making any particular object, which I have, conceptualized into an object separate from myself. And it will start to disintegrate in a little bit and start to break down a little bit. And then it usually, comes back again to the table again. But I keep feeling there's something more radical to this, that it's like getting so far, and I want it to go into something that really changes it for me, and it doesn't happen. And I think it's something I'm just going to have to be formulating as I work with this.
Well, let me make a rash suggestion or observation. I mean, not being a meditation teacher or anything, I sort of feel like when I make these kind of suggestions, I'm venturing into dangerous territory, but I'll do it anyhow. You're talking about investigating this from the point of view of causes and conditions, i.e. the past. But you're not talking about investigating it from the point of view of the future. So you're not looking at it from the point of view of outcomes. You're not looking at it from the point of view, in fact, of relationship with other beings. And you're not looking at it from the point of view of nurturing others and an expression of the Bodhisattva vow.
Yeah, I can do all that. I can look at from those things, but you still, even if you're looking at a potato in terms of all those things, there's still a potato.
That's right. That's right. It's still a potato.
And where is it not a potato anymore?
I never said it was not a potato. No place where I said it was not a potato. But there's different ways for it to be a potato. And one way for it to be a potato is to be a mere potato. And the other way for it to be a potato is something that you're about to hand the Buddha. And I'll tell you, in my experience, when I'm about to hand vegetable to the Buddha, it is not the same as just sitting there on the table. It's like the whole emotional dimension to it, the whole meaning of it, the whole expansion of it, there's like a profundity to it in that context, which is just not the same. It's an expression of, well, Reb's talking about compassion these days. Yeah. But he's talking about precepts. He's talking about active engagement in the world in a certain way. When you start looking at interdependence from the point of view of other beings in the future rather than in the past, when you're looking at dedicating what you're doing to others, it takes on an emotional transformative tone, which my intuition is that's what you're asking about. It's still just a potato. I'm not ever going to say it's anything more than just a potato. But you see, the fantasy, the problem is not that it's a vegetable sitting on the table in front of you. The problem is, what is the mind that you bring to it? And when you bring a non-sacral mind to it, it's a non-sacral experience. And when you bring a sacred mind to it, it's a sacred experience. It's still just a potato. But everything else about it is completely different. And that's the sort of thing I'm sort of... It's, you see, Nagarjuna, who was like the master philosopher of this, was called the holy Nagarjuna. He was holy, right? He was not a dried up, desiccated philosopher, right? He was a holy being, because this philosophy is not about this kind of Western, I don't know, you get up in your head and you become non-human in some weird way. You know what I mean?
So you're saying that basically through an intellectual method, you're not going to reach that point where it changes into something?
No, you can. Through an intellectual method, you can reach the point where the experience is transformed and the imaginative dimension to it, the meaning of it, the relationship to it, the appearance of it is utterly transformed. You can do that through a strictly logical, analytic, intellectual method. Right? That'll do it. That is actually the Buddhist tradition of how to do it. It'll have that outcome. But the outcome is not merely an intellectual outcome. It's not merely an abstract outcome. It's an outcome which transforms perception, which transforms emotion, which transforms one's relationship with others, which transforms the entire sense of the future. It's the whole of the Bodhisattva way is completely embedded in understanding the practical application of emptiness. It all grows out of that. It's completely, it's like it stands on it the way a Buddha sits on a lotus. The whole Mahayana sits on the practical application of emptiness. So, I don't know, that's pretty strong. I mean, I'm saying this pretty strongly, and it's just sort of like an assertion for us to investigate. But my sense is that this does not, this Mahayanistic kind of view does not come out of looking at causes and conditions. It comes out of looking at outcomes. That when you look at causes and conditions, you're looking at excellent ways to cut off the roots of suffering. It's almost like maybe I could make a distinction between Hinayana and Mahayana. When you look at causes and conditions in the present moment, it's an excellent way to cut off the roots of suffering. But I don't know if by itself it's an adequate way to really tread the Mahayana. Something about looking at the future and the present that I've already said. So I got it over my head anyhow, didn't I? Yes. But did I kind of wait a minute before?
Well, no, I'll touch about it later.
All right. We'll tussle over.
You seem to have mentioned truth a lot.
Truth.
You mentioned the word truth a lot. And especially what's just going on right now, I put down certain thoughts just come through my mind all the time. It seems to be from your perception. Truth and is an experience, or just a clearer perception of the awareness of a placed fantasy, and that fantasy is based on you thinking that it's a wholesome fantasy. If it becomes a wholesome fantasy, then you believe in it's good, it's right, it's truthful.
Oh, yeah. Somehow I've said something that's really led you astray, then, because that's really not what I'm intending to say. I mean, if that's the conclusion that everyone's drawing, then there's a real problem. I really created a problem here in class. Because, see, I see this use of the imagination as a praxis, as a technology, as a technique. But I don't see it as a way of discerning truth. I see it as a way of practicing so truth can appear. But this way of practicing is rooted, as I said earlier, in a pre-existent exploration of middle way philosophy. Okay. Now, there are rules for discerning truth in that process of exploration. And if you follow those rules and certain understanding emerges, then based on that understanding you can employ fantasy in a productive way. But it's rooted in that pre-existing experience. And there are very definitive ways for discerning what is truthful from what is not truthful in that philosophical investigation, in that analytic investigation, which has nothing to do with imagination.
Yeah, it's a laborious job.
It's a very laborious job. It's a very precise job.
Mm-hmm.
These two go hand in hand. And I think that maybe the piece that's missing here is that if this were a Tibetan audience, okay, one would understand that the practice of Tantra, for example, is the creative use of the imagination, goes hand in hand with philosophical investigation of the nature of emptiness, that these are not separate from each other, that they interpenetrate each other, and that they depend on each other in certain practical kinds of ways. And because that's not the tradition in this audience, that's not self-apparent. But I'm so schooled in it that maybe there's ways in which I'm not being entirely clear.
Okay. The reason why I picked on that, because that's been my kind of fuel, is that I must find out where I'm astray, and I must find out the truth on this.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody talks about it in such a way, because I have a very vivid imagination, that imagination is almost kept me alive, that kind of thing. So, and the way you described the way you felt about this kind of almost a revelation of, wow, Kurt did put that, and not being in the now, but also past and present at the same time, that full cycle,
mm-hmm.
is, I actually want to feel like that. That sounds pretty amazing, but then I have to question, where am I coming from? Am I just placing a fantasy on David's fantasy? Or
yeah.
There's also yeah. something about what Stuart was saying about the Zen thing. I just did three little things like Zen, being in the now equals boredom, and from that boredom, it provokes an action, mental or physical, but it provokes action, and then the imagination comes in with more focus.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the boredom,
mm-hmm.
because of Zen, you end up with this. I think Stuart is much more eloquent than I am, but it seemed to make sense that because of Zen, you actually had this kind of revelation.
Well,
can you say that? Is that a path?
You can sort of say that, yes. I could say yes because of Zen. I had this quote revelation. Not a word I especially like, but
no, I don't like it either.
Yes, I could say that. Because of the insistence in this community of working in a certain kind of way and the value of doing that, then certainly this kind of experience emerged from me. It's not the sort of experience that would emerge for a monk in Tibetan monastery, necessarily, although it might. Because the monks don't usually work in the kitchen, although they have other kinds of work that they do. So they could, in fact, have this kind of experience. Reb has talked about the importance of how you work with boredom. That when you get bored, it's a time of great opportunity. You need to use it in a certain way in your zazen. And if I say use it in a certain way, that sounds pretty problematic, I think. But when you're sitting in a sesshin, when you really hit boredom, that's a very important time. I've heard him say this, that this is a time when you can something can really start to happen, right? But it sort of depends upon how you sit with that boredom as to what will then happen. For me, facing that boredom in the kitchen was a catalyst for something happening. That's definitely correct. But it's also important to recognize that I came to working in the kitchen after 10 years of studying Middle Way philosophy with some great teachers. Right. So there was this field had been cultivated before that seed was planted. Okay. So there's some place in this process where, I guess I'm not overtly saying this, but I suppose that there's some sort of advertisement going up here for, kind of hard-headed study of Middle Way philosophy. But that's not what this class is about. I mean, I've sort of, presented that kind of thing in the past here. I want to do something radically different this time, which is more inspiring and in some ways concrete and less abstract and analytic. One last question. I don't know if you're going to be around here next week, but I think Sarah will be. So I'll take his question.
I was trying to think of the parallel in my own experience. I don't work with potatoes, but I work with people's dreams. And there comes a time often when there's a choice of helping somebody see something in one framework rather than another. And there's a creation of reality that comes out of either moving in one direction or another, and those realities are not equivalent. And they're not totally arbitrary. They have limits. I'm really interested in what determines the limits. I mean, it's as if there's a certain plasticity to the way mind works, to the way the unconscious mind works. But it has its limits as mm-hmm. to how far you can go.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me in what I've read about the imagination and Sufi work, or I know it in the Freudian work, they don't talk about it that way, but I see it that way as imaginative productions. And now you're talking about it here in terms of Tibetan Buddhist way. But I'm interested in what the foundation is that allows for a certain amount of plasticity or but sets a limit. In other words, it's like real imagination and there's useless imagination or irrelevant or destructive.
Well, that distinction that you're making between useful and useless or destructive imagination, I'm making that distinction from the pragmatic point of view of spiritual practice. So I'm saying this is useful and that's not. Yeah, I won't say that that's arbitrary, but I will say it's very intentional. But I don't know that it speaks to the question you're asking about the limits of the plasticity of the mind. I mean, there's several questions in the sense that you sort of put in some Chinese boxes inside of Chinese boxes inside of Chinese boxes. As far as I can tell, in regards to the question of the plasticity of the mind, what I understand is that the limits of what mind is capable of fantasizing about, if that's one question, is that there are no limits to what mind is capable of fantasizing about. But there are limits to, no, that's not quite right. It seems that let me do this from a Buddhist point of view. From a Buddhist point of view, it seems that all fantasy will be predicated on the nature of selfhood. That, in a sense, if you look for a fulcrum like Archimedes' fulcrum, okay, or if you look for the aqua regia or the fundamental beyond this, there isn't anything kind of something. That or the reality limit or the edge, you know, whatever kind of language you want, that this idea of the selfhood is it. Because when you get beyond that, if you eradicate that, then there are no more things. And so there's no thinking going on because thinking involves thinking about things. Okay. And once that's there, you can think about anything. But anything you think about has selfhood. And it's sort of like, I don't know, that's some sort of horizon line, if you will. Because when you cross it, then content is gone. And before you cross it, content is there, whatever the content may be. And so that, in a sense, if there's a limit to plasticity, I think that might be where the Buddhists put it. In terms of total fantasy.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of reality, there's a different issue, which is that there's many different schools of Buddhist thought which address the question of the relationship between the productions of mind and objective reality, and what is the relationship between those. There's not one single Buddhist answer to that relationship. The Madhyamaka answer to that relationship, which is the only answer that I'll give in this class, the Madhyamaka answer is that there is an external reality of a certain character which is really of that character. It's not arbitrary, but it's also not knowable. It's a noumen. Okay? And then there is mind, which creates many kinds of ideas and fantasies and what have you. Now, in fact, the relationship between the two is such that there is a relationship, and that actual physical reality does exert some degree of limitation on our fantasies just because of historic experience. And this is in addition to the whole thing about selfhood.
I was with you too, you said just because of historic experience.
That means our experience of many lifetimes of incarnation, if you will. That's what I mean by historic experience.
But I appreciate your answer.
But what I'm trying to say is that we are a consciousness that has existed for many lifetimes, and in those many lifetimes, we've accumulated a stock of types of experience. Mm-hmm. And that stock of types of experience in itself is therefore limiting of what we can and can't fantasize about. That's what I'm trying to say.
And some of that will fit with whatever the inherent nature of the object is, and some of it.
Well, what we fantasize about now fits in some way with external noumenal reality because we've gone through many lifetimes of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we found food and we've eaten it,
right.
This kind of thing. But there's some sort of confluence that's happened, but I don't think you can say anything more about it than that. And I may have actually already pushed the limit of Buddhist thought on this issue. I may have actually overstepped it, I'm not sure. I'm not aware of anybody having ever asked that question. In fact, I mean, probably some Buddhist philosopher has, and I've just never read the question anyplace. So I'm making up an answer. That's always dangerous.
That's what you're talking about.
No, it's not. No, it's not. Because remember, I'm saying that I'm talking about making up fantasies that are rooted in a pre-existing philosophical training. I'm not talking about making up fantasies which are just any old fantasy. I'm talking about specific use of the imagination, not generalized use of the imagination. If I was talking about generalized use of the imagination, I wouldn't be too much different than some of the people floating around at the state hospitals when they used to be open. May our intentions equally penetrate every meaning and place where the true merit of Buddha's way, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know what? I have found one of your words.